Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guests today are a pair of avid gamers who have decided to immortalize the importance of the art that Dungeons & Dragons gave us and how that art affected the artists' lives, the gamers' lives, fantasy and science fiction as we know it, and so much more. So Kelly Slagle, Seth
Polansky.
I was going to say Pekansky, and I'm like, that's not right. Are the writer, director, co-producer of a movie called The Eye of the Beholder, The Art of Dungeons and Dragons, which is, in my book, a wondrous deep dive into the art we all recognize and didn't even know it was from gaming until maybe like 10 years after. I was like, hey, wait a minute. Dungeons and Dragons, really? So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Where did the idea to do a documentary about the art of Dungeons and Dragons come from?
Well, I mean, there's three of us. Brian Stillman couldn't be here. He is the third member of the production team.
He's the co-director and cinematographer
for
the film.
So we met him several years ago at a small convention in Rockville called Intervention Con.
Okay.
And both of our previous films were screening there, and we just got to meet each other and hang out all weekend and talk about our love of film and all things geeky. And several weeks later, he floated this idea by us of doing a, hey, are you interested in doing a Dungeons & Dragons documentary? And my response was, of course, but there have been a couple that have been done. There are a couple in production now. One of them's embroiled in litigation. So we were trying to avoid topics that have been done before. And we thought, what is one piece of Dungeons & Dragons that really hasn't been touched on? And we hit upon the art, because it influences everything. It's been influenced by so many things. And it, you know, the trading card games, the covers of board games, video games, it's all been influenced by this type of art. And we thought, well, what better to do a documentary about and that people would love and immediately have a visceral reaction, because you can see it all right there on the screen. And you probably had experiences with it as a child or an adult. Yeah. So yeah, that was sort of the genesis of the idea.
Yeah, the art on the covers of the original manuals that I got back in, I don't know, early college years, early 80s, mid 80s, when they were starting to like take off. That art sticks in my head. I still have I guess it's a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle with the Larry Elmore with the red dragon and the
awesome
barbarian. I got that on a whim. I saw it and I'm like, there's puzzles? Really?
I actually didn't know that there was a puzzle of that.
That's great.
There's a whole line of puzzles of all the art from Elmore's the one who I've seen. Was it Dickinson?
Mm-hmm. Parkinson, maybe?
Parkinson, yeah. I think there's a puzzle of that. But if you Google search TSR Dungeons and Dragons puzzles, there's like There's five of them. And that Elmore one is just iconic.
Of course.
And I'm upset because the first time I put it together, it was complete. Then 5 years later, I went to put it together. There
was
one piece missing. And I blame my roommate's cat.
I'm sure.
My roommate at the time had a very precocious cat, and I blame that feline. But yeah, the books, the artwork. If I could have gotten posters or prints of a lot of those covers, I would have. And just, how did you approach all of the artists? Because there are so many from day one, literally through to today almost. And they are, you can see that they are still passionate about the work that they did.
Yeah, Brian spearheaded the effort to figure out which artists we were going to approach, because we had to cover over 40 years worth of artists. And so we had a hard time.
And we knew.
Whittling it down. We knew we weren't going to get everyone.
And we knew we were going to have people who were perturbed that we didn't get everyone.
You know, but we wanted to have a good representation of all the different eras of art. So we made sure we had people, we had a lot of the original people, because they're the ones who started everything, but also for fan service, because we knew that's who they'd be looking for. But we wanted to make sure we had people represented from every, you know, edition of the artwork, of the game. and have a good representation from each era.
And we also approached it in a manner that would not drive Kelly completely mad, because at the end of the day,
I was the editor, so we ended up at 40 interviews.
How many hours of footage?
Documentary and 72 hours of footage.
Wow.
So there were still people that Brian and Seth both wanted to interview after we hit 40, and I finally had to cut us off. Because we had, at that point, we had a date where we needed to finish a first cut of the film by in order to enter the Gen Con Film Festival. And I was like, no more. We can't interview anymore.
And I mean, at the end of the day, she has to know where in that 72 hours of footage one person says one thing. Mm-hmm. So
it wasn't just we could have gone on and had 10 more interviews easily. So we had to draw the line somewhere is basically what happened.
But that's what extras on Blu-rays are for.
Well, we do have extras on Blu-ray. We have about
over an hour of extras.
2 hours of extras on the Blu-ray. So,
really?
So, okay. Yeah. Then that was with the current 40 people that we had. So just imagine, you know, what we could have. It would have been a 10-year effort if instead of a 3 or 4-year effort.
Wow. That's still a dedication, the fact that that many people would have said, you want to talk about that? Yeah, sure. And then just, because some of them get really, really deep into how the art affected them, how like their art affected somebody else, and then how that art affected somebody else. And some of the stories are very funny. I wish there were more of them.
Well, there's, you know, some of the interviews were 3 or 4 hours long, so there's a lot that, you know, we had to put on the cutting room floor. But we you know, in the editing process, we settled on the best stories and the best themes.
I mean, there were some interviews where the interview subject started to cry, and then Brian and I started to cry, and just these incredible memories from childhood where John Shindahedi was the art director for a long time. And he told us this story about when he joined the military, he passed on all of his Dungeons and Dragons books to his brother so his brother could teach his kids how to play. Wow. And then now here we are 20 years later, and his brother has passed those very same books back to John so John could teach his kids how to play. And it's just amazing to watch how these things bring families together and they pass down through the years.
And, you know, the only reason that story wasn't included is because it was more about the game and not as much about the artwork. Mm. So, you know, there was lots of stories told about the game that we couldn't include because it wasn't necessarily concentrated on the artwork. And we decided to focus the documentary just on the artwork. So
where did you draw that line? Because to me, the artwork, especially on like the DM screen,
sure,
and the maps and stuff, the artwork is so tied into,
sure,
the way you play the game.
So, I mean, we do discuss the importance of the artwork to the game and how it functions within the game in the documentary. So we had to make that connection very clear. But we did have to lean towards more stories about the art itself and about the artists themselves, because that's what we were focusing on.
I mean, and we touch in part on how the art has influenced everything that came after. You know, there's one line in the film, and I'll spoil it, but it's before D&D, there wasn't this is what fantasy art should look like.
Right.
After Dungeons and Dragons in the mid 80s, people point at Dungeons and Dragons art and go, this is what fantasy art looks like. And it's just a very, it's a really resonant statement for a lot of reasons. You know,
and the art that came in the 80s really caught my attention, because if I remember correctly, the first dragons I saw in artwork was Michael Whalen.
Okay.
Remember that the white dragon? Mm-hmm. Those dragons that he drew for those three books, those three Pern novels that came out right then. I mean, White Dragon was brand new in 78, and that artwork blew my mind. And I was like, huh, that's kind of a smallish dragon. And go on to read the book, it's a smallish dragon. But
yep,
those dragons caught my eye. And then later on, you've got Elmore's dragons. Mm-hmm. And then all of the other dragons that came along, the dragons for Dragonlance. The
they were re-envisioned.
The covers of those books blew me away. The there was a poster. I remember seeing a poster of a silver dragon going, whoa. And
well, God, I'm glad you said that.
Those just stick in my mind. You know?
We have an entire section of the movie devoted to dragons and how dragons have progressed.
Yes, there's an entire... obviously, we couldn't not do a section on dragons particularly, and just like we couldn't not do a section on beholder monsters right. mm-hmm. as well. So, you know, so we do, we spend a good amount of time on the evolution of the dragons through and the way different artists treated them throughout the years.
And there's some fun, interesting anecdotes about, you know, the first time people got to TSR and the first time they were asked to draw a dragon. Larry Elmore, I went to the library and I got a book on reptiles and a book on dinosaurs. Okay, I guess I'm drawing a dragon. And it's a great story.
And great stories about, you know, Jeff Easley sharing that the dragon he drew on the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, was it?
Monster Manual.
Monster Manual was like the second dragon he ever did.
And he's like, oh, I'm not very happy with it.
Or the first dragon he ever painted, you know.
And it's this iconic piece that everybody knows mm-hmm. that he's, you know, it's the first one I ever did. And I probably wouldn't have done this or that or...
Yeah. And the beholder, the evolution of the beholder over yep. the years. I always thought that was a creepy monster.
Yeah, yeah, it is a creepy monster.
It's when I first heard the description of it, I hadn't seen a picture of it. And in my mind, it was a bloody eyeball because somebody sure. had gouged that out of a monster.
Oh, okay.
And the nerve endings and the blood vessels sprouted eyes after it
oh,
was
that's
removed.
Creepy.
From whatever monster it was moved. So it's just like there's some monster chained up in a dungeon somewhere. And every single time an evil mage needs a beholder, he just goes down and plucks an eye out. And then it grows back and he goes down and plucks out
that's
another one.
That's awful and great.
That's gross.
It's terrifying, isn't it? Yeah. But that's what I saw in my head when I first heard the description of a beholder. And then you see the pictures, I'm like, well, that's not as gross. Oh my God, it's got teeth.
Yeah.
Lots of teeth. And they've evolved over the years from the little beach ball thing to this floating thing with that's basically a floating jaw.
Mm-hmm. Now, for some of the art that was created, for me, seeing the documentary, the most heartbreaking story was when they said, you know, they'd been sold... And they were throwing out
the original art. Yeah.
Now, I sat there and went, who do I stab?
Yeah, a lot of people back then were saying that, who do I stab? Yeah, we will never know exactly how much was lost because it was, thank God for some people who worked there, they were able to recover some of it, but...
So they did not recover all of it.
They did not recover all of it.
Certainly not.
No.
Yes, it's infuriating
That's
to
criminal.
Think about.
That's yeah. criminal.
How do you mistake original artwork for garbage? I can't even fathom.
It was a deliberate choice that was made. It's crazy to think that would happen. But you know, thank God for artists like Diesel LaForce and others who were able to recover a bunch of that artwork.
Yeah, I mean, even if your entire life has been about bookkeeping and numbers, you can see that that's a painting on a canvas on a frame.
A lot of it was not on a frame or anything like that. A lot of it was black and white artwork that was done on paper.
These people never read comics. They never
but
saw
they just didn't have any. You know, who knows? We can't speculate on their exact reasonings and what exactly happened. Right. But
it is just sad to think that there is a very large section of America that has no appreciation for art, no idea what art is, what it looks like, or that it's
and
valuable.
The documentary. We're hoping, you know, even people who don't game, you know, will check it out and see and gain a new appreciation for that kind of artwork.
Yeah, because those early artists actually influenced a lot of other people to start drawing fantasy art or science fiction art. Where would the tattoo industry be without these guys?
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's and the word for it, we discovered as we progressed, the word is imaginative realism. So that is the brand of artwork, imaginative
really?
Realism.
Imaginative yeah. realism, yeah.
So we don't call it fantasy art, apparently, in the industry. It is imaginative realism. Imaginative realism.
How'd they get there?
Because they don't...
Fantasy art's not just... Well, go ahead.
When you say the words fantasy art, what does that conjure in your mind? Does it conjure a wizard airbrushed on the side of a van?
Maybe.
In a lot of people's minds, that's what it is. So they want something, the people who work in this industry, and rightly so, their work is valuable, it's important, it's gorgeous art.
It's mm-hmm. fine art.
Exactly. And the term to sell it to the fine art industry is imaginative realism. Okay. And it's the word that gets them, you know, studio shows and gallery shows and accepted in the fine art world. And more power to them for embracing it.
And that encompasses science fiction art as well.
Yeah.
It's all fantastical art. It's imaginative realism is the proper term.
Interesting.
I mean, we just learned that. So.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known that had we not made this film.
I would not have known that ever. Because I have gone to comic cons and seen comic artists drawing something for a fan sitting right there. I've seen the storyboards, the oversized boards that they have for sale. I used to have one.
And cool.
That how you can look at that art and not consider it
real art.
Real art, yeah. I was going to say just important. I mean,
yeah.
The dragons, the monsters, the ghouls, the animated skeletons, Lord Soth's charge.
Lord Soth's charge.
That's a Excellent. Parkinson, yeah.
I mean, how do you look at Frazetta's death dealer and not be overwhelmed with awe? Seriously.
It sounds like a personal flaw.
Nope, I mean, I'm with you.
Everybody likes Frazetta's Conan. I was more particular to the Tarzans. Because the Tarzans, because there's just so much, he put so much life into those foliage scenes.
Mm-hmm. What you can't see on the podcast
trading
is,
cards.
It's a Magic the Gathering deck that's sleeved in Frank Frazetta art.
Oh.
So the sleeves to my cards are in Frank Frazetta artwork. Yeah.
That is very cool. That is very cool. But yeah, just hearing the stories from the artists themselves was a treasure because he's like, you don't know how long they're going to be around, but you want to appreciate them for the influence they had. Because 40 years ago, none of this existed or none of this was taken seriously. And how many artists all over the world have been influenced by what they've done? They deserve few hundred thousand golf claps.
Yep.
I mean, DeviantArt exists as a website because mm-hmm. of fantastical art. I mean, because of imaginative realism.
Yeah.
Realism.
I've seen some great fan art come through DeviantArt, through other means, and you can tell. It's like, I know whose dragons that person
who they were looking at
influenced by, and just hearing the stories directly from them. For me, was a delight, especially the stories about the pranks.
Yeah, we like the behind the scenes stories about what went on in the office and things like that.
Dart games kill us. Like, we just found out about it during the course of the interviews, and then of course that became a question we had mm-hmm. to ask to all the artists. You know, mm-hmm. tell us more about the dart games. Tell us more about the pranks, and it just became a thing.
The one. Where they said, yeah, we skipped a rubber band across the oil paint, so we had to fix the oil. He's like, I don't think he knows yet. And the shot of his face going, what?
Yeah.
So that he didn't discover that when we were interviewing him. Uh-huh. He discovered that for the first time when we screened it with him and the gentleman telling the story.
Just for the listeners, there's a story about how the artists were playing games with the rubber bands in the office, and one of them hit one of the paintings and left a mark, and somebody had to fix the person's oil painting without them knowing.
And of course they found out during the screening that
and the artist didn't find out till our screening that this actually happened in the office 30 years ago. So
but the look on his face,
it was priceless.
And the guy's desk being up on the ceiling,
yep,
that takes dedication.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
that takes dedication and just a commitment. A commitment you don't see very often anymore. Just I'm going to put
part of our goal, and we discussed this before we started shooting, was to we wanted to give people a visceral sense of what it was like to be in that TSR bullpen in the 80s and in the early 90s. What it was like to be there with those guys painting all together in a big room. Like, I mean, the Four Horsemen, the most amazing fantasy painters of the last 20 years, 30, 40 years, right? And what it was like to be in that room. And we actually have Margaret Weiss, mm-hmm. tell the story about returning to the art department just a few years ago at GaryCon, and there's still the floor is still covered in paint, the same paint that was there, you know, 30 years ago. So that's an amazing story, and it just gives you a sense for what kind of history happened in that room.
For you, what was the most, I guess, influential, or the story that clicked for you and said, "Yeah, we're doing something special here."
You want to answer? I got mine.
Go ahead.
You want to think about it for a second.
Share your story.
We interviewed Larry Elmore, and we interviewed Larry in his studio, and he has these paint braces that he uses to hold his arm against the painting, so he's not actually touching the painting.
They're wooden braces that lay on his easel.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're covered in some gunk, right? He uses the brush, dips it in his paint, wipes off the excess on this brace. He held it up sideways to the camera, and it's about 2 inches of built-up paint, and he explained that every Larry Elmore painting for the past 30 years has a piece of paint on this board. He could probably sell those for $500,000. I mean,
I think he's leaving them to
his children.
His children,
but
yeah.
I mean, I have goosebumps while I'm sitting here telling this story. Every Larry Elmore painting over the last 30 years, that board has a piece of paint on it from that painting, and you just look at it and go, "Holy crap!"
I remember seeing that part in the film, and I don't think it dawned on me that
lump of paint,
little lump, was all just paint.
Yep,
and that's even more profound. Like, every single one. Wow.
Yeah.
So how about you?
I don't know. I was trying to think, you know, I, as editor, I get steeped in all of it and you know, it, like everything means something to me, I think. The art getting thrown out story was very poignant. I like some of the silly things. Like there's a story, where Brahm is talking about how the artists and the management at TSR had a little bit of a disconnect. And he talks about how someone approached Jeff Easley about doing a cover, and the management insisted that he use his most expensive paints on the cover to make it better somehow. And then another story where they insisted that he use all of his paint colors to make it better.
So if it wasn't, you know, rainbow colored, it was somehow less valuable or important.
And so it's those stories that really got me, not so much on the poignant side, but more on the silly side.
You know, there's one other too that I just have to bring up.
Okay.
So can you imagine loving your job so much that you prop your window open at night so you can break in to go to work before the building opens? So Diesel told us that story, and he loved his job so much, and he didn't have keys to the building, that he'd prop his window open at night so he could get in early to go to work because he loved painting at TSR so much. And that just floors me, to love anything so much that you would break into your job, your workplace, early to do it. That's just astounding.
Yeah, that's special. That's how you know that's your calling. That's your life. You found your spot.
Absolutely.
You found your spot.
And he did it for 20 years.
Nice. Yeah, this film just brought back so many memories. And just remembering playing the games, looking at the art on the different volumes of the manuals as they came out. I actually had one friend in high school who did have the monster manual with the Cthulhu mythos in it. I saw it for myself. I'm like, whoa. And then years later.
That was Deities and Demigods.
The Deities and Demigods. Yeah. Yeah. Source book.
But later, you looking through them like, hey, where's Cthulhu? They took that out years ago. What?
And you know what else? They took out Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. They took out basically they took out anything that they shouldn't have published in the first place because they didn't have an actual license for it.
They didn't have a license for it, yeah. Fafhrd and Grey Mouser stuff. I remember, I actually have those books with Mike Mignola covers.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep.
They took out the Elric stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
Lessons in intellectual property. As the attorney, it amuses me to find out a lot of these things.
Do people put those illicit editions up on
sale? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's as they're used books at this point.
Oh, you can find them, yeah.
But they're several hundred dollars.
They're expensive. Yeah. That's what I was getting at. So, for you, both of you, what... Well, you said you spent like 20 years editing.
No. It was about 6 months of hardcore editing to work on the film.
Now, where has it been screened so far? Like, what fan groups have seen it?
We've screened it at the Gen Con Film Festival, the Boston Sci-Fi Film Festival,
Pensacon,
Clifton Film Celebration, where we won Best Documentary there. We won Best Documentary at Gen Con Film Festival as well. What was the other one?
Pensacon.
We did that in Pensacola, Florida.
We haven't heard back from Dragon Con. We assume it will be in, but we can't say for sure. It'll be screening at Origins and Gen Con again this year.
Okay.
Yep, Origins Film Festival.
We run it, though, so we can't.
But we run the Origins Film Festival.
So we can't win our own film festival.
We just put it, it's not in competition, it's just being shown. It's going to be shown at Gen Con again this year. Yeah, so.
May 14th was the release date. On iTunes, Google Play,
Amazon,
a streaming platform,
YouTube,
or a television platform near you.
Yes.
So it's on demand.
So it's everywhere now for everyone to get, which is great.
So at the various screenings that you've done since you started putting it out there, what has been the fan reaction to it?
It's been overwhelmingly really enthusiastic and positive.
Except for the one or two fans who are prickly and are annoyed that we didn't cover their particular favorite artist.
Oh, but it's very very rare. It, like the I wouldn't even say we get negative comments. I think there's just people go, oh, why didn't you include this person? And you know, we have to tell them we couldn't include everybody because we had to stop at some
there
point.
There never would have been a movie if just...
but yeah, people love the movie, and so far all the feedback has been very positive.
Cool. Yeah. So are you going to take a breather and then dive into another documentary?
We are in the very beginning stages of another documentary that we can't really talk about yet, but it will be appealing to the same audience.
Or a very similar audience.
Very similar audience,
excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thank you for indulging my questions, because like I said, I haven't played D&D in years, but I remember.
Now's a great time to get back in.
Yeah, all of those games. All of those games were just so much fun. Groups of friends gathering every Friday night until 3 in the morning, snacking on Cheetos and drinking whatever happened to be available. And hopefully this will rekindle or just cause a whole lot of people to go, yeah, I miss playing. And jump back in, because like I said, the art is so influential. It's so visceral to a lot of people. And
agreed.
I'm one of them.
Great.
So Seth, Kelly, thank you.
Thank you
so much for sharing your passion for this with us. And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock. Peter Watts. Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Hi, I'm Aaron Ashmore from Sci-Fi's Killjoys, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
When I think of all of the science fiction and fantasy and horror art that has stopped me in my tracks
in complete awe of the skill and talent that went into creating that image. I've seen storyboard artists, comics artists who draw these amazing panels that we eventually see in comics, and it boggles me. I'm like, how do you do that? I tried to draw when I was young. It wasn't pretty, so I stuck with just writing words that made pretty images in people's heads. I had a chance long ago to buy a limited edition print of the cover of Dragon Prince that was painted by Michael Whalen. And unfortunately for me, some lucky gent in Ireland got the last one mere hours before I called in to order it. So if you're listening, thank you for breaking my heart, really. I hope you're treating it well. I hope it has a place of honor on one of your walls where you can stare at it, just bask in the glory of that wonderful painting. There's a few other pieces of art where if I had the means, I would have a high-quality print or an original of, but that's neither here nor there. I wish more people could view art and appreciate it the way some of us do. I mean, there are books and books, coffee table books. The Titan Books out of the UK publishes these glorious art books, I think maybe one or two a year. They have one of the posters of Drew Struzan, you know, the Harry Potter, the Star Wars. I believe there are several books out there covering the art of Dave Dorman. What was the other one? Chris Foss, who did all those amazing photorealistic paintings of spaceships for all those 70s and early 80s covers. If you've seen the Blu-ray poster, the Blu-ray cover of the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune, that's a Chris Foss painting. I have maybe two or three Michael Whalen art books. And there have been some others. I can't remember them off the top of my head because the ones I do have are in storage. But that art has completely changed the way we view genre art. At least I think so. And to correct myself, I was getting Frazetta's Tarzan mixed up with Vallejo's Tarzan. Both are memorable, impact-making, stunning. But yeah, the one with the entire jungle around him, that was a Vallejo. Another person who took imaginative realistic art to another level, especially when it came to Valkyries and Amazons and warrior women. Come to think of it, he did a Fofford and Gray Mouser cover himself. Huh. How about that? Anyway, if you get the chance, go see Eye of the Beholder. It is a fascinating look at the art so many of us took for granted in our early days of playing Dungeons and Dragons, and I guess of the other artists who were inspired by those paintings to go paint stuff of their own. Me, I can't draw, but that's besides the question. But if you have any questions or comments about Dungeons and Dragons or art or anything in that vein, go ahead and call. The number is 602-635-6976, or send an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. And you can also leave comments on the website. Someone just this week left a comment asking how he could get a Star Trek collectible appraised. And I actually don't know that off the top of my head or who reputable to send him to. He says he's got what he believes is an original series Star Trek communicator. He's done a little bit of research on the web already, and that's why he believes it's an original prop from the original series, but he wants to have it appraised and authenticated. Most importantly, authenticated. And I am not sure where to send him. If you know where I could direct this gentleman's inquiry, please let me know. Call or email, or hit me up on Twitter. Or leave a comment in the post for this show on sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, and Player FM. I guess real soon now that iTunes is going to change to Apple Podcasts. I'm not sure how that's going to work yet, but right now I'm a little dismayed because I think I'm not going to be able to use my first generation iPod Touch to listen to podcasts and music anymore because iTunes still syncs to that little puppy. It is 12 years old. It's still running iOS version 3. And iTunes doesn't care. iTunes just goes, yo, sup? And it syncs the podcasts I listen to. And I listen to those when I'm out driving or at the gym. That's what I use my iPod for. I don't need podcasts on my phone. And no, I don't have an iPhone. I am not a fan of the iPhone. I love Apple, but the iPhone, it bugs me. I don't know why. But I love my first generation iPod Touch. It still works. It does everything I need it to do, which is play music, play podcasts, and let me play Bejeweled when I get bored. That is all I need it for. And I'm worried because I already know the Apple Podcasts app requires iOS 10 and higher. So I'm still figuring out what I'm going to do when iTunes finally goes away. I'm hoping it takes at least a year, maybe more, to actually get everything out of iTunes. So we'll see what happens there. But I guess if you're going to rate a podcast, you should do it on Apple Podcasts now. I'm going to have to look into that. Update things so that you guys are going to the right place to give us good reviews. iTunes/Apple or Stitcher are places where you can leave reviews for Slice of Sci-Fi right now. So check those out. Help us out. Give us a review. Give us a good rating. And that will make other people go, hey, maybe I should check this one out too. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. You can follow us on YouTube. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there. I believe by the time you hear this, Darren and Noah's review of Godzilla King of the Monsters will be up. They were not thrilled. They were kind of unamused. And I will let you check out the review and hear their opinion for yourselves. And of course, we have the website, sliceofscifi.com, where you can leave comments on the reviews, on the interviews, on the shows, and leave your own rating for the reviews, the movies and TV shows that we've checked out for you. And the website is where you can enter the Secret Sauce Contest. Right now, there is a contest being held to give away some goodies. The way to enter that contest is by listening to this show. First, you go to the website, sliceofscifi.com, click on the Contact Us link, and you'll see a magic form. fill out that form. Make sure your email address is valid, because otherwise I can't reply to you and get you your swag. In the subject, choose have a different question. In the message box, type in the phrase, the night is dark and full of terrors. When you do that, a magical list should appear of various prizes you can select from. Choose one, choose two, choose three, and then hit submit. And when we close the contest, people will be randomly selected. So it's better to pick more than one, because if your one gets given away before you're selected, you should have a backup. Just saying. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting the show. Your donations and your pledges help keep things online around here. For Slice of Sci-Fi, for Writers After Dark, for Babylon Podcast, for Charlie Jade. And, yeah, Dragon Page is still out there. I'm changing that feed up a little bit, but all the ones that are online will stay online for the foreseeable future. The only ones shutting down are Pop Culture Geeks, Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas, and Winging It Archives. So go grab those now if you want to keep a bit of history for yourself. If you want to help add your support to the Slice of Sci-Fi family of shows, you can go over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/sliceofscifi, and sign up to become a patron, a patron of the show, and be eligible for some other goodies over there. Or if you just want to leave a one-time donation every now and then, you can use the PayPal link, which is at paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. I'd like to also throw out a loving shout-out to the geek rock band Sci-Fried for providing the theme music for the show. I love you guys. Can't wait to hear your next album. You have to let me know when it's coming out, all right? But if you want to check out other geek rock originals and parodies by the guys, go over to their website, sci-fried.com, or check out the music videos they've done over on YouTube. You will be entertained. But that will do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.